It's good to be here. This takes me back to when I was little and came to this church with my mother and my sisters, at least to this building, not necessarily to this church. So it's a little bit different. You know, the church or the ecclesia is not a building. It's a gathering of people. And this gathering of people is very different than the one that gathered here when I was a child. Well, I was asked to talk about the sort of the history or the story about the churches here in Amberson Valley. And so I have entitled my talk, Faith and Community in Amberson Valley from 1760 to 1900. And I decided to stop at 1900 because it would just get too long. And there's just there's enough interesting thing to say. This is a map. This thing here works? Yeah. This is a map of, I have to go back there. This is a map of Amberson Valley from 1858. And we are, let me see here, we are about right in here. Okay. Here's the road coming down through the mountain. Okay. Through Clark's Knob there. And coming over here, and so on. And then this is going down and opening up into Path Valley. Okay? So that's from a 1858 map of Franklin County. It's kind of an interesting map. All right. Amberson was named after a man by the name of Francis Amberson. And he's sort of a mystery person. Not much is known about him. He moved into the area maybe in the 1750s, which is very early on. There is no record of him being here in any of the, mainly in those days, from that period of time, most of what you know about somebody is when they bought land or they made a will or they paid taxes. For most people, you don't know much about other than those things. You have to go to kind of government records to find out about most people. And there's none of that about Francis Amberson. And believe you me, I have tried to find it. Okay? There isn't. But back in the 1960s, there was a man by the name of Harry Foreman who went around and he wrote a number of local histories for Franklin County. He did one on Amberson Valley. In Amberson. And at that particular time, as he was visiting people, he visited a couple of older people in the valley. And here in their possession, they had two documents, two different families had two documents that was a record of Francis Amberson's daughters releasing their claim to his property here in Amberson to Barnabas Clark. And this is a drawing, a map of that property. And it's right there. And if you buy that place on Saturday, you will be buying part of Francis Amberson's property, what was his claim. All right. And Barnabas Clark bought it from him and also married his widow. Okay, he married his widow and bought his daughter's claim, their part of their claim to his to what his claim was. And then Barnabas Clark lived there until he died in 1820. And what's so interesting to me about him is that, this way. When he died, he left a will, and in that will, he left part of a bequest here, and it says, I bequeath, demise, and dispose in the following manner and from form. First, I give and bequeath unto the Reverend Charles Herring $20, and I bequeath to the Roman Catholic Church in Chambersburg the sum of $4, and the sum of $4 to the Roman Catholic Church in Path Valley, Fannett Township. Okay? So Barnabas Clark was Roman Catholic, all right? And I assume he's Roman Catholic, otherwise why would he be giving money to, first of all, to a priest, and then to the parish in Chambersburg, and then to the parish, and then to Roman Catholic Church in Path Valley. And so that's from the 1820s. And we do know that up in the upper part of the valley here, there was a set of families, the Shields, the Fagans, the Rays, the Prices, and so on, who were Roman Catholic. And over near Dolesburg, there was another set, another cluster of Roman Catholic families. And the families here, the Roman Catholic families in Amberson Valley, would cross the mountain. There was a path that was referred to as the Catholic Path. I don't know exactly. I've never been on it. My father told me years ago. I mean, he knew where it was, but he said it's all grown up now. When I tried to get him maybe 40 years ago to show me where it was, he says, "Oh, it's all grown up, Bethel. Wouldn't be able to make a way over there." But they would cross the mountain in this path and go to church over near Dolesburg. All right. Now, there was never a Catholic church in this valley, but there were Roman Catholics in the early years. And then in the 1850s, they never had a priest. They never had a resident priest. And that's sort of the story of Amberson Valley. Very, very seldom did any of the churches ever have resident pastors. Okay? And this is even particularly true of the Roman Catholics. But in the 1850s, there was a priest from Philadelphia who essentially had a mental breakdown. And so the bishop sent him out to Path Valley to pastor this very small flock. Basically, it was kind of a thing for him to recuperate. The burden wouldn't be too much and so on. But while he was here for several years. While he was here, he was able to get the congregation to build Our Lady of Refuge Catholic Church, which is still there. It was built in the 1850s. I think a number of years ago, there was a fire, and they actually the structure was still there, but they had the interiors is all done. What's interesting, though, is that, and this is true, this is a true across the board here in the valley. You know, in our tradition here, who do we want our young people to marry? We want our young people to marry Mennonites, right? That's what you really want to have happen, right? You don't want them to marry a Catholic. All right, and that's but among folks here in Amberson Valley, even though there were different churches, there weren't really strong lines about who you could court and who you could marry. Now, the Roman Catholics were a little stronger about that, but they didn't really have strong oversight. A priest would come to Path Valley once a month and hold mass, and that's all they had, and you know, it was probably just for a day or two or something. Maybe they'd come over for another period, but it was a very they didn't have a lot of oversight. And so what happened is that young people are young people, and they took a liking to the people that their neighbors, their fellow students in school and so on like that. And so you had Catholics marrying Methodists or Presbyterians, Methodists marrying Presbyterians and United Brethren and so on like that. So there wasn't really a really hard line when it came to church affiliation. There was some fluidity there. Now, there were certain families that tended to be Methodist. There were certain families that tended to be Presbyterian and so on like that, but it really wasn't a hard and fast line. And what happened with most of the families, those Catholic families up in the northern part, up in the upper part of the valley, is later generations changed their church affiliation to either Presbyterian, Methodist, or United Brethren. Okay. But I want to then look at some of these other churches. This is an application of Cromwell McVitie. For 100 acres situated in Amberson Valley, bounded by lands of the application of William Lynn on such terms as pleased to grant, I can't read the rest of them, and then as the signature, Cromwell McVitie. Cromwell McVitie actually lived in Lancaster County, and he never lived here, okay? He made an application, and an application was the first thing you did. You basically said, okay, I want this piece of ground, 100 acres. It's next to this other piece of ground and everything. And that gave you kind of a color of title to it. That was the first thing. So you claimed that piece of ground. You hadn't made any money for it other than a small registration fee. That is in 1766. So already by 1766, this area is referred to as Amberson Valley. Okay? But Francis Amberson is gone. All right? And this is his land. All right? This is the 100 acres. And then he bought another piece of ground and so on. And the ground that we are sitting, that this church building is on right now, is part of that property that Cromwell McVitie claimed. Now, then he got a warrant for it, and then after you get a warrant, the land is surveyed, and then later on, you pay the full price. After you've paid the full price for the land, you get a patent, which was a deed from the province or from the state. Okay, and then you had full. And there were times in which people they just simply had the application, and they lived on the land, they improved it, and so on like that, and would at maybe years later get a warrant, and even maybe years later yet get a deed. But they nonetheless they had color of title to the land. All right, they had a claim to it. All right. Now, Cromwell McVitie never got here. All right, but some of his children did. His daughter Elizabeth, his daughter Edward, his daughter Anne, that's John, his son John, and his daughter Anne. And Edward McVitie was the one who bought. He was one of the older boys, and he paid his siblings for his father's land here in Amberson Valley. He had an older brother who stayed in Lancaster County and got his father's property in Lancaster County. But he came here and paid his other siblings for his father's land here. And he had the house right up here, which is no longer standing. I can actually show you a picture of it. This is right here. When I was growing up, this was the Clark and Carrie Craig place. And this, it caught on fire a number of years ago, and they tore it down, and you can see here the log structure. It's really kind of neat. I was really sad when they tore that down, but it did mean that I could see the how the thing was built, okay? So that dates from the 1790s, okay? They moved in here in the 1790s, all right? Now, the first organized church in this area were the Presbyterians. Okay, one of the things that's problematic in colonial Pennsylvania and in much of the Americas is that they didn't have enough ministers. They didn't have enough pastors, particularly churches that depended on quote unquote educated clergy, all right? And the Presbyterians were one of them. Now, actually, the Presbyterians did better than most other churches, okay? And so in the 1760s, they weren't here very long. It's really in the 1760s that Path Valley and Amberson Valley first gets settled, all right? The French and Indian War had come to an end. The boundary was pushed back. They could actually come in and settle the area. There were some people in here before that and so on, but life was pretty precarious for them. But in the 1760s, the Presbyterians did organize a congregation in Path Valley. And, of course, Amberson opened up in the Path Valley, and a lot of some of the people who lived here went with the Presbyterian Church. And the first minister was a man by the name of Samuel Dougal. And this is a photograph. It's actually taken from an old newspaper from the 1930s. This is a photograph of his house in the lower part of Amberson Valley. When I was growing up, that's where the Wolfs lived. There, I think there's an Amish owned that land, that farm now. So he was here until he died in 1791. And he was a resident pastor. It's interesting in the in the censuses and so on, he actually had a slave or two. He was a slave owner, which is kind of interesting to me. But the Presbyterians did emphasize having a learned clergy, but they also here in Pennsylvania and New Jersey had schools for the training of ministers, and so they actually had more ministers. And one of the things that's different about Presbyterians, of course, Presbyterians were Calvinist originally. Some of them aren't so much that way anymore. But they were originally Calvinist, and they also, their form of government was a presbytery, which was each congregation had a presbytery or a group of elders who basically governed the church. And they in a Presbyterian church, they would, and they still do it this way, okay, if they need a minister, they will go looking for one. And the presbyters or the elders in the church will go and look for a minister, and they will they'll often go to other churches and listen to other ministers and then give them an invitation. Won't you come to our church? All right. And so that's how it was done, and that is how it is done now. Now, sometimes they were young men who were just finished with their training and so on, and they were ordained for it and came. And so in 1791, we had this man by the name of David Denny, and he's here until 1809. And then he leaves because there was another church over in the Cumberland Valley, a bigger church, probably offered him a better salary, and he went over there, okay? And then in 1802, okay, we have Amos A. McGinley coming here. And he is here for over 50 years. He's here for over 50 years. Now, he has... the Presbyterian Church in Spring Run. He also was responsible for the Presbyterian Church in Fannettsburg. He was responsible for the Presbyterian Church over in Burt Cabins, and also for the Presbyterian Church up in Tuscarora. Okay, so he had four churches to take care of. All right, and he was a very popular preacher. In fact, one of the things that's interesting is there's lots of people in Amberson and Path Valley who named their sons after him. Okay, they called them, now they didn't call him Amos, they called him McGinley. Okay, my grandmother had an Uncle Gin, and his name was McGinley Culberson, and he was named after this McGinley, Amos McGinley. Or A.A. McGinley has come. I had one of my ancestors was named Edward McGinley McVitie. Actually, was Edward McVitie's youngest boy, and they called him Gin, which is kind of an interesting way of referring to him. But he was a very people went to him to get married. He kept a marriage record of all the people that he married. And which is kind of nice because it tells us when lots of people here in the valley and in Path Valley were married and so on. This is a passage from an article about the Presbyterian churches here in Amberson and Path Valleys, and talks about Dr. McGinley, okay, or Reverend Amos McGinley. From the commencement of his labors in this field, Dr. McGinley was in the habit of preaching occasionally at stated times at the head of the valley. This is in Amberson Valley. Thus he did sometimes at Taylor's Sulphur Springs, which aspired to be somewhat of a watering place and fashionable summer resort in the early part of the present century, and sometimes elsewhere in the neighborhood. Sometimes the service was held in private houses, sometimes in barns, and sometimes in the open air. Now, Taylor's Sulphur Springs was up toward the head of the valley. I'm trying to think. What's their name? Jacinka? Do you know who I mean? They live, you go up Stuart Road, and it's on the left. It was used to be owned by Tom Piper. In fact, the woman who lives there now is a granddaughter, I think a granddaughter, a great-granddaughter of the Pipers. But there was a sulfur spring there, and the Taylor family, Casper Taylor, commercialized it. He built these little cabins, and he basically dug kind of a pool, and people came there to drink that water, to bathe in the water, and it was sort of a little fairly crude and primitive resort. All right. Later on in the 1850s, his son Samuel kind of revived it and improved it and so on. But I think that by the 1860s, it wasn't really functioning anymore. But it says, among the visitors who attended the spring in the summer of 1820 and for several seasons after was a minister who had belonged to the established Church of England in his native land by the name of Williams. On coming to this country, he did not identify himself with the Episcopal Church, nor indeed with any other, but occupied a quasi-independent position. His views and sympathies, however, were with the Episcopal Church. While attending the Springs, he frequently preached to the visitors. The people of the neighborhood were also wanted to hear him and were favorably impressed with his preaching. He frequently mingled with them in their homes, and being sociable in his disposition and easy and loquacious in his manner, he thus ingratiated himself into their confidence and affection. Now, you have to remember, this is how a Presbyterian writing this, okay? All right. Thus encouraged, he conceived the idea of establishing an independent congregation, and with this in view, bent his energies to secure the erection of a house of worship. This met with popular favor, and thus largely, if not mainly through his instrumentality, was erected about the year 1823, the little church at the head of Amberson Valley. Okay? And this is a picture of that church. And it sat right here in the cemetery in the corner. You may notice that that over that way is all these very old tombstones, but there's the corner there, which are more modern tombstones. And the reason why, that was where the original Union Church stood. And so that's why there weren't older tombstones there, because there actually was a building there, okay? And so this was built in 1823, and the report goes on, but although successful in this part of his enterprise, he failed in the other, visa the establishment of an independent organization. Mr. McGinley, then in the vigor of early manhood, was not disposed to sit quietly by and see a portion of his flock led off by this movement. And who can say he was not right? His views on church order and polity, no less than on doctrinal points, were clear and decided. That meant he was a very thoroughgoing Presbyterian. Hence, he regarded the attitude of Mr. N. as irregular and disorderly, and the whole movement was as wrong both in spirit and deed. Hence, he applied himself energetically to thwart the designs of his intruding rival. In a short time, Mr. N. became discouraged and retired from the field. Two years ago, he was still living, and though an old man, wonderfully retained the sprightliness and vivacity which distinguished him in his younger days. At that time, your speaker met and spent part of an evening with him in Baltimore. He had not forgotten those scenes nearly half a century ago, and he still maintained that had it not been for the efforts and influence of Mr. McGinley, he could have taken all of Amberson Valley with him. Now, again, one of the things you have to keep in mind is that there's no resident pastors here. So for this person to come in and provide some spiritual continuity. I mean, he's there. He's probably preaching more regularly. People are hungry for that. They're eager for it. But Mr. McGinley, who lives down further in Path Valley, is not to be. He stands in the way of that. All right. And it's fair. Like I said, he was a very, very popular person. Now, what's interesting about this account, which was written in the 1870s about what happened in the 1820s, is that there is actually a deed for the Union Church and Cemetery, and Edward and Margaret McVitie. And if you look over in the cemetery there, and you see this great big monument here, it kind of stands out. That's Edward and Margaret McVitie's tombstone. All right, he was a justice of the peace. He was also an elder in the Presbyterian Church, and so on. He's a very important kind of person here in the valley. Okay, but on this indenture made the 21st day of May in the year of our Lord 1823, by and between Edward McVitie and Margaret, his wife, of one part, and Daniel Piper, Sr., Adam Speck, John McVitie, Casper Taylor, John Stake, trustees of the church now building in Emerson Valley, Fannett Township, County, and State of Pennsylvania, the other part, witness that the said Edward McVitie and Margaret, his wife, holding a certain tract of patent land situated in said valley, now know all people that we, the said Edward and Mark McVitie, for in the consideration of our grant or promise to grant and convey for the same of said church and burial ground a certain piece of ground. Therefore, we by these presents do confirm to the said Daniel Piper, Adam Speck, John McVitie, Casper Taylor, and John Stake, and their successors as trustees for the said church forever, a certain lot of ground whereon a new church is now raised or building. Now, there are already, before the church was built, there are already a couple graves there, okay? And so, in a sense, the cemetery started before the church was built there, okay? And that Union Church, I should just go back and mention it here. These men, all right, Daniel Piper was United Brethren, okay? The Stakes later on became Methodists, though they probably weren't Methodists then, because as far as we know, there wasn't an organized Methodist class here until the 1830s, okay? Casper Taylor, he was the one who had Taylor Spring, and probably later on, well, I mean, he was probably Presbyterian also. So we have persons. This is a Union Church. It's not owned by any particular denomination. It's a community effort, and it's being used by all the various churches of whatever affiliation people, except for the Catholics. Okay, the Catholics are not included. All right. Now, in the 1840s, there's a man by the name of Newton Culberson. He's actually a grandson of Edward McVitie, and his family lived on the property where Patsy Campbell lived. When I was growing up, it was Nelson and Alice McGee's, Patsy's parents, who lived there. Okay, he had bought a portion of his father-in-law's property and so on. And his son Newton, then later on, they moved out to Iowa. And so as an old man, Newton Culberson, who was a Presbyterian missionary in China, wrote sort of a reminiscence of his childhood. And in that, he talks about the early years. He was here, he's probably not much more than 10 years old when he left. So what he's talking about here is what he's remembering from when he was around 10 or so, which is kind of, you know, what do you remember when you're 10? But it's kind of amazing what he talked about. He said, our section of the valley boasted a church building, the only one in the valley. It was built of logs, weatherboard on the outside, plastered within, and painted without a particle of ornament. The windows had outside blinds, but I never saw them open. There was a center aisle, the men on the left side and the women on the right side. Are you all on the right side? Is that right? Is that how you do it? No, is that right? I can't. Are you? It's backwards. See, that's Mennonites for you. They do it backwards from everybody else. All right. The preaching was of that virile type, which left the center no loophole for escape. And, of course, you're one of these guys is Amos McKinley. It was simply believe what I'm telling you or be damned. I think it was probably, maybe that's a 10-year-old perspective. I have a feeling there was a little bit more substance to that. There was reverence, seriousness, and sincerity. Thus saith the Lord was not lost on the hearers. It enabled men and women to smile at hardships, to do and adore. It was a preaching needed for that age. He said, I like to go to church. There was in that quiet of the place and the subdued manner of the people a gentleness not apparent on weekdays, a toning down of the rough exterior. Everyone was in his best clothes, on his best behavior. The stress and haste of the life were left outside for a time. The mind shared in the physical reaction relief, and there felt on our souls a comforting sense of the reality and presence of the infinite. The church was also a public clearinghouse for information. Important news found easy circulation. It was a time and place for friendly intercourse, neighborhood gossip, where cares and drudgeries of the past week were forgotten. And one of the things I should mention is that because there was this Union Church that the Presbyterians used, the Methodists used, the United Brethren used, okay, and they would be on a schedule kind of, all right, And normally, Amos McGinley would come up once a month and preach, okay? And traveling United Brethren minister or a circuit riding Methodist minister would be on a schedule for them. And so, you know, certainly if you were Presbyterian, you were going to try to get the church there when there was a Presbyterian service. But people didn't limit themselves to that. You know, if there was a United Brethren preacher coming through or a Methodist preacher coming through, you know, they would often go to those services too. In 1851, a newspaper reporter was visiting the area, and he said, near the center of the valley, and this is from the 1858 map, okay, so right there you can see the Union Church. Here's a store, not quite exactly where it is today, but almost where it used to be, okay, and here we are coming, this is Clark's Knob here, who are coming down the valley. This is the Francis Amberson track, and then this area here is what was originally the Edward McVitie track here. So, and then over here is where my dad grew up, or across the creek. All right, near the center valley on a commanding eminence surrounded by a beautiful arbor is situated the Union Church, where the citizens religiously repair to worship and the gospel is regularly preached. Religious instruction being piously dispensed and Christian ordinances duly observed. The valley is also well provided with neat and comfortable schoolhouses and suitable distance from each other where the children are taught the rudiments of a sound English education. Now, even though, like I said, there was, even though there was a lot of mingling, and like I said, particularly, you know, young people didn't really pay attention to what church the person they decide they like belonged to, and so on. There were differences. In 1868 and 1869, there was a young woman by the name of Martha McNeil. She was actually from over in Shade Valley, but she taught at the Mill Run School, which is farther up the valley. It's no longer there. And she lived with a Stuart family, and the Stuarts were United Brethren, but she was Presbyterian. And she was Presbyterian of a very decided character, okay? She was a strong Presbyterian. And she wrote letters back home to her fiancé for her future husband while she was here. She didn't really enjoy being here in Amberson Valley. From her letters, there's a lot of complaint in them and so on like that. But she does talk one time about Mr. West. This is William West. He was the pastor from 1853 to 1873. And she says this about him. Mr. West, and this is in the Union Church, preached an excellent sermon from the words in the 93rd Psalm. Thy testimonies are very sure. He spoke of the promises to the Christian being very sure, and we should never doubt them. And the promises to the penitent are sure, and none should despair of mercy. And that the threatenings against sinners are awful, and that they can be saved only on the easy terms of the gospel. I like Mr. West so much. He speaks so gently, so firmly. One is impressed with the solemnity and truthfulness of his subject. I think he's a good Christian and tries to do good to others. Now, so they're using the Union Church, but in the 1870s, and I think it might reflect the fact that the Union Church may not be quite big enough anymore. The population has increased in the valley. There are probably more people going to church. And so in the 1870s, the Presbyterians and the Methodists decide to build their own church houses, okay? The Methodists are first, and we'll talk about them a little bit later on, but I kind of do want to talk about them. Since we're looking at the Presbyterians here, I want to talk about them first. The person here, the couple here, okay, is James and Janetta Culberson. And James Culberson and Janetta lived in the house right next to us, okay? And he was an elder in the Presbyterian church. And he's kind of the person behind the Presbyterians here in Amberson Valley, who belong to the Upper Path Valley Presbyterian Church. Now, after Amos McGinley stepped down as an old man, he had those several churches he was taking care of, but I guess they decided, and it probably reflected the fact that there were simply more people, a larger population, the church was bigger, but they actually divided the thing. And so then William West only had Spring Run and Amberson to take care of. All right. And he would preach down in Spring Run and then come up here and preach. Now, he didn't come up every week. He only came up every other week and preached. And that was the practice up until as long as I remember that church was held every other week in the Presbyterian Church. And then church was held every other week in the Methodist Church. And they switched back and forth. And each church had its own Sunday school. And so there were people, I remember there were people who were Methodists who would go to the Presbyterian Church on the Methodist off Sunday and then come over here for Sunday school. And there were some Presbyterians who would do the same kind of thing. They'd come to the Methodist Church and they would go back for their Sunday school. Okay. And there were some, early on, there certainly were some doctrinal issues. There were some issues, differences as far as polity and so on like that. But one of the things you had to remember is which church you were in that Sunday, how you should say the Lord's Prayer. Because the Methodists said, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And the Presbyterians said, forgive us our debts. All right. Now, I had a great-grandmother who was raised Presbyterian. Her mother was a very strong Presbyterian, but she married a Methodist, and he was a very strong Methodist. And so she had to become a Methodist, but she never would say, forgive us our trespasses. So one of my grandma told me that her mother always sat beside the same woman in church, and Myrtle said, Mary would never bend. She would never say, forgive us our trespasses. She was still a Presbyterian at heart. Okay. So in 1878, they built that meeting house, which is the one over here, and you can see kind of how it looks. It's similar. They covered it over and everything like that. I don't remember it looking like that. Okay. By the time I came, they had already kind of built that little front piece onto it and so on, an entryway. All right. Now, let's switch over and look at the United Brethren. All right. The United Brethren came out of a religious movement in the late 1700s, early 1800s that people refer to as the German Awakening. And this was a movement that was really influenced somewhat by Methodism, even though they weren't Methodist. All right. And there was a traveling United Brethren minister over in Chambersburg by the name of Samuel Huber, whose parents, by the way, were Mennonites. They had been Mennonites, but when the United Brethren movement started, they switched over to United Brethren. And most of their sons became United Brethren ministers. And Samuel Huber, he wrote an autobiography later on. He talks about coming over here to Amberson Valley. They preached in a circuit, okay? There would be preaching points, and they would travel in a circuit, and they would preach, okay, and hold services, okay? At length, he says, I resolved to make another trial, but out of my own neighborhood. Hereto I had not officiated outside of it. Accordingly, at the request of Brother David Fleck, a young man who had been converted in my house, I went with him to Amberson Valley. And the Flecks were one of those families that lived here in Amberson Valley. We went there through a deep snow. When he arrived at his father's house, the father asked me, what brought you over here? I replied, I came to hold meetings in your house this night. He sent his youngest son on horseback to invite the people to come to a meeting. About 18 persons attended. I opened the meeting with singing and prayer and then delivered an exhortation. After this, we continued to sing and pray, during which time 5 persons remained on their knees, being under conviction, crying for mercy. And before the meeting concluded that night, the mother of the family and 2 of her daughters were made happy in a sin-pardoning God. On this occasion, Okay. At one time, while I was preaching in Brother David Fleck's house in Amberson Valley, the power of God arrested his brother John, who was convinced and converted in a very short time. He leaped up and praised God, and after I had spoken in German, I was told that the congregation was mostly English. So Samuel Huber was used to speaking in German. He was of German background, and the Flecks were of German background, too. Okay, but again, that kind of reflects what was here in the valley, because there were people of German descent, there were people of English descent, there were people of Scotch-Irish descent, and so on. And I should speak in English. My speaking being mostly in German, I was but imperfectly versed in the English language. However, I consented to do so, and after I was done speaking in English, an Irish Roman Catholic who probably never heard the gospel preached by a Roman priest rose up and with tears in his eyes said, "I wish that God Almighty had sent his convictions on me in place of John Fleck. I have as much need of them as he has. Poor sinner, who would not approve of his candor and sincerity?" And so that's probably somebody, he's not naming it, it's probably some of those Catholics who live up in the northern upper end of the valley who were convicted. So again, you can kind of see how things are shaking out. And then he goes on, Sam Huber goes on to talk about a meeting held in Brother Daniel Piper's house. I preached in English. A young woman, as she afterwards stated, took her seat close to the bedroom door. Conviction seized her. She got up, intending to jump out of the house to get out of the reach of such power, but she fell down in the bedroom, laid there in agony for some time, wrestling in prayer until she was blessed. Six other persons attained mercy that night before the meeting was closed. And Daniel Piper, his father, Adam Piper, had moved into the area in the 1780s, died shortly a few years later, and then Daniel purchased his father's farm, and that's his tombstone there. Okay, and it says elsewhere that United Brethren meetings were held regularly in Daniel Piper's house. So this was his house became a preaching point for the United Brethren. He died in 1838, but his widow, Mary Witter Piper, lived to 1865, and that's a photograph of her. She looks like she could be a Mennonite, couldn't she? Her cap's a little fancier for a Mennonite, but no, not too bad, not too bad. So it is. But the United Brethren were plain people back then, okay? And Daniel and Mary are ancestors of mine, too. But that's no big deal, because if you grew up in Amberson Valley, everybody's your ancestor, okay? At least back, okay? So, all right. Now, Martha McNeil, on the other hand, this Presbyterian woman who stayed with these United Brethren people, and it's a real cross to her. She writes in 1868, "The United Brethren had communion. The exercises were impressive and furnished abundant food for thought. They wanted the solemnity that always pervades in such an occasion our dear old church, and I did not enjoy it so much." And one of the things you have to keep in mind is the Presbyterians were a lot more staid and serious. The United Brethren, there was a lot of emotion in their worship, okay, early on. I mean, that description I just read about that woman's conversion and so on, I mean, that it was a very emotional kind of religious experience, that United Brethren, it's a Methodist, early Methodist kind of experience. I did not enjoy it much, but probably the fault was my own. My prejudices are strong. I never enjoy myself so well in any church as my own. The man that preached the sermon I did not like. He was rather dull, looked not at all prepossessing in appearance, and I did not like his sermon very well. It was all about what we should do to obtain our own salvation. He appeared to preach that we could work our salvation for ourselves. His text was 1 Peter 5, chapter and 4th verse. A splendid subject for such occasion, but he'd done very poorly, I think. And so I think her observation here reflects the fact, here she is, a Presbyterian Calvinist, and she doesn't really like this United Brethren emphasis about, essentially, that one should live a holy life. That, I mean, that's a Methodist kind of concern, too. I mean, Methodists believed in free will, that you could make a decision, and then that you were supposed to live a holy life as a consequence. It wasn't the Presbyterians didn't think you should live holy lives. It wasn't that. It's just that they were much more insistent that, you know, you were kind of elected to it. There was nothing you could do about it one way or another. Now, in I forgot to put the date on that, but that's in the 1880s. There's this notice in the newspaper, quite an interesting Bush meeting is now being held by Reverend Nichols at Laurel Grove in Amberson Valley. He is assisted by Reverend Young of Newburgh. A Bush meeting is a term for an outside meeting. We would refer to them as kind of a tent meeting. They probably didn't have tents, but actually what people used to do is they would build these kind of arbors, and they would cover them with brush or with and so on, sort of to give some protection from the sun and so on. And they would have revival meetings in those. And down at Laurel Grove, there was a schoolhouse. And the Varner family lived next door to there, and they were early United Brethren people. And the schoolhouse became then a preaching point for the United Brethren. But then in 1894, they built their first church house, which is the Laurel. And there you can see what it looks like. Looked like in 1894. Reverends J.P. Anthony and A.R. Ayers and A.B. Myers laid the cornerstone for a new United Brethren Church in Amberson Valley Friday at 10:30 a.m. A good crowd was present to witness the ceremony. Okay, so that's when that church house was built. Now it's a United Methodist Church. Okay, and that reflects the fact of some mergers that happened. All right. In the 1880s, the United Brethren split over the question of lodge membership, and the old constitution or the more conservative group stayed with the original position that lodge membership in the Masons and so on was not allowed. The quote unquote liberals allowed it, okay, and the Laurel Grove Church went with the liberals, okay. Then in the 1930s, the liberal United Brethren joined with the Evangelical Association and became known as Evangelical United Brethren. And then in the 1960s, the Evangelical United Brethren merged with the Methodist Church and became United Methodist. And so that's how this, what was originally a United Brethren Church, became a United Methodist Church. So that's why there are two United Methodist churches in Amberson Valley that are only a few miles apart, because at one time they were actually two different church groups. They were very similar in their theology. They were different in their polity. The Methodist Church had a much more, a much stricter polity and organization than what the United Brethren did. In fact, that was one of the things the United Brethren, early in their formation, had sort of explored the, because they were essentially Methodist in their theology and so on, had explored the idea of linking up with the Methodist, but the Methodist said, you guys are just too loosely run. Your organization is too loose. And so it didn't really work. All right? Now, in 1868, Martha McNeil, again writing to her beau, is attending a Methodist big meeting. All right. I attended church today. The Methodist big meeting is now in progress. And this may have been in the Union Church, but it may have also been a Bush meeting. Okay. And this is big meeting is probably referring to a series of revival meetings. We are addressed by Reverend Krause. I enjoyed the sermon very much. Indeed, his text was, "Will thou not receive us again, that thy people may rejoice?" He spoke of the way and manner in which we should approach into the presence of the Most High. He said we should come humbly, sincerely, in faith, believing that God will answer our prayers and bless our souls. He spoke much of our duty, and we could not expect a blessing if we lived in neglect of any known duty. He said that God worked by means, and said everyone had a work to perform, and he urged them as they valued their soul's salvation to be up and doing. Now, she's more impressed with this guy than she was with the United Brethren, and apparently he must have been a very fairly able speaker and preacher and so on. But I need to just sort of say a few things. Methodism came into into North America in the 1770s. Okay, it's actually right along the time of the Revolution, and it spreads. Okay, John Wesley, who was really a Church of England minister, came up with, and he never left the Church of England, really, himself, but he kind of built alongside it a parallel organization to evangelize and to gather people into little groups. They were called classes. And so he would go into an area, he would preach, people would be converted. He would organize those converts into a class. He would point a person as a class leader. And then, of course, more preachers came along, and the thing expanded and grew and so on until and it comes over to North America here. And the difference between the Presbyterians and the Methodists is the Methodists did not, even though they had learned, educated clergy, they did not insist upon that. Okay, they did not insist upon that. And so they actually had an organization that was much more adaptable to the North America scene. And so that's why when you go through Pennsylvania here, particularly this area of Pennsylvania, that's why you see all these little Methodist churches. Okay? Because wherever there was a group gathered, they could organize a class, a congregation, beginnings of a congregation, and then itinerant ministers would travel in a circuit from one congregation, one class to one congregation preaching. Okay? And so there was just like, so there was never really, occasionally there was a Methodist minister who lived here in the valley, but for the most part they did not. Okay, for the most part, they did not. They just simply visited the congregation or the class in its in their circuit. In 1871, it talks about a camp meeting under the supervision of the Methodist Protestant Church will commence on the 24th instant near the farm of Nicholas Best in Amberson Valley. A large number of tents are expected. The location is fine and easy of access. And so, again, the Methodists had tent meetings. They had revival meetings, sometimes referred to as protracted meetings. These were definitely things to get converts, okay? I should just mention it said Methodist Protestant. The Methodists, originally, when they were organized here in North America by Francis Asbury in the 1790s, they were referred to as Methodist Episcopal, and that's because they had a church government where they had bishops who were at the top, and then there were ministers who were ordained, and then there were local preachers who were not necessarily ordained. Okay, now some of those local preachers could work themselves into becoming ordained ministers, all right? But in the Methodist Episcopal Church, the decisions were made by the leadership. They would meet together in conferences, and there they would make decisions for the whole church. And they would even make decisions at, one of the main things they did was they made decisions about who is going to be preaching in what circuit. All right? My grandmother used to say that, and that was the practice among the Methodists, it probably still is as far as I know, is that the Presbyterians got to choose who their ministers were. And normally speaking, unless there was conflict with that minister, they served for years. Okay? Unless somebody came by from a bigger church with a higher salary and offered them a better job. Okay? But normally speaking, they stayed there for years. With the Methodist, you got switched out about every 5 years. So you did. And that was the pattern, okay? And again, though, it was kind of the thing. My grandma always said when she was growing, said we were one of the churches that got the young guys who were just simply being trained. And once they got trained and so on, some bigger church got a hold of. Went to some bigger church. But that was not a decision they made. That was a decision that the conference made. All right. But there were some Methodists who objected to that because they objected to the fact that all the decisions were being made in these conferences of ministers. And so they objected to that. And so in 1822, a bunch of Methodists broke with the Methodist Episcopal Church, and they formed what became known as the Methodist Protestant Church. And the difference in polity there was that they actually had lay delegates to the conference. So actually lay people were appointed by the congregations and they went to the conference and they shared in the decision-making thing. And I remember my grandma talking about when she was young, she said, well, you know, we were Methodist, a Protestant. And that was a very kind of important distinction for her. But in the 1930s, the Methodist Episcopals and most of the Methodist Protestants, not a lot of them in the South didn't do that, but most of the Methodist Protestants merged together and became the Methodist Church. And then again in the 1960s, the Methodist Church and the Evangelical United Brethren merged into the United Methodist Church. But here's a description from, so in 1874-75, the Methodists are the first ones to build a church, and that's this building that we're in right now. And as you can see, it's configured a little bit different. There is a bell tower there with a bell and so on. Later on, they added that tower in the front. And you can also see that there are two doors. Do you notice that? One for the women and one for the men. Okay. My grandma remembers when she was born in 1916, she says she remembers as a girl when some of the first families, like young couples, married couples, decided they were going to sit together in church. That probably was in the 1920s and so on. That was just how it was, you know. Some of the things we think about, we're just simply doing because that's how it was. I think it's good that men and women sit separately. That's my personal opinion. But almost all churches were doing that. Okay, in 1883, again, a report in the newspaper, there is another mark of improvement plainly seen by all in Amberson Valley. Christianity is spreading. The Church of God is going forward. Winning victory after victory. It was my pleasure to attend the service at the Methodist Protestant Church on Sunday the 5th instant. The church was filled to its utmost capacity. The pastor, Reverend S.T. Ferguson, had previously announced he would hold an all-day service exclusively for the Sabbath school. He accordingly invited all irrespective denominational distinctions to join with him in his church. In this good work, it was a grand meeting. The pastor in his address gave good and wholesome advice to the young. And if what he said is heeded, the time will soon come when Amberson Valley will be a stronghold of righteousness. The pastor was kindly assisted by Brother Jacob Stewart, George McGee, Wilson Piper, Herbert Piper, Noah Funston, and others, all of whom spoke good and cheering words to adults and children. The music was of high order under the leadership of John A. Shoemaker. And John A. Shoemaker was a justice of the peace. He owned the store here in Amberson, and he was also often a lay delegate to the Methodist Protestant Conference from here. And Mrs. Laura Peisel presided at the organ. Take it all in all, it was a success, and no doubt its fruits will be seen and felt in years to come. And what's interesting here is S.T. Ferguson, he was only here for about 5 years, but he seems to have been a very energetic pastor and minister. Now, he not only pastored Amberson, but he also had the Methodist Protestant Church at Roxbury and the Methodist Protestant Church at Concord and so on. This was just one of his churches that he had to take care of. And eventually he was moved on by 1887. And so it talks here about him being at the Fourth Quarterly Conference of the Concord Circuit. That's this set of churches that Amberson was part of. And preaching was by the pastor. And then on Sabbath, we'll meet on Sunday, February 14th at 1 o'clock here in the Amberson Valley Church, and preaching by the pastor. And then at 10 o'clock, okay, that day, he had been over at Roxbury preaching. So these guys had to travel a lot. So they did, all right? And then in 1887, it mentions that Reverend S.T. Ferguson, a member of the Maryland Methodist Protestant Conference, and for the last 4 years, pastor of the Roxbury and Amberson Valley Churches, has been appointed to take charge of the Liberty Church in Maryland. He will deliver a farewell sermon at Dillsburg on Sunday, April 24th, at Amberson at 7:30 p.m., and friends of the retiring pastor are respectfully invited to these closing services. So he's giving his farewell sermons here. He's only here for 4 years. But like I say, he's kind of very energetic. and he's sort of a power behind what's happening here. And then on June 1st, 1887, there's an announcement about the Reverend John V. Holmes, the recently appointed minister to Methodist Protestant churches of Roxbury and Amberson Valley, has taken up his residence in the latter place. And he's the only person I really, and there probably were others, but he's the only person I actually came across to who actually lived here in the valley during his pastorate. Even though he was taking care of Roxbury and Concord and Dolesburg as well. So, but like I said before, the Methodists, they were organized into classes. And in that earlier article, it talked about N.M. Funston. That's Noah Funston. And he was the class leader. And so he was really the person here in the valley on the ground who was considered to be during these years, probably 1880s, 1890s. He died in 1904, I think, only in his 50s and so on. He's my great grandfather. Yeah. And he had a book called The Methodist Protestant Discipline. And in that book, he had recorded his class, who was a part of his class. This is from 1887. Now, this is right on the heels of Ferguson leaving, all right? And so he's really the response. I mean, Ferguson comes and preaches here. You know, he's here, you know, whenever it's his time to preach. He's probably here for meetings and so on. But the day-to-day, week-to-week kind of, in a sense, pastoral work and so on is done by these lay class leaders. And Noah Funston was not. Frank Stewart told me that his mother, who was a niece of Noah Funston, told him, Frank didn't know him, he died before Frank was even a little born, but she said that when the Methodist preacher couldn't come, Uncle Noe preached. And so that was just assumed that could be done. You know, that was no problem. So this is his list of persons in his class. Altogether, there are 85 members. And I think about that. You know, 85 members would have filled this church out really well. So it was. This is probably kind of the heyday of it. All right? Now, let me see here. Now, one of the things that's so interesting, though, is that even though there are these different churches, and of course by the 1870s, the Methodists have their own church house, the Presbyterians have their own church house, the United Brethren are probably using Laurel Grove Schoolhouse, and then they build a church house in 1894. They're still getting together for things. And one of the things that they get together for is the Sunday School Association. There was a Sunday School Association here in Amberson's and Path Valleys, in which all the Methodists, the United Brethren, and Presbyterians all participated in. All right? And this is an account of one happening in 1886. And these were annual events for probably 25, 30 years. These existed. And sometimes they were held here at Amberson Methodist, sometimes they were held over in the Presbyterian Church. And I'm not going to read this whole thing because it's getting a little long here, but Mr. N. Funston, that's Noah Funston, made the address of welcome. He's the class leader here. And he's probably also heavily involved in Sunday school work and so on. And the Reverend J. S. Gordon, that's this fellow right here. Let me see here. He is actually the Presbyterian minister at Fannettsburg. Okay? Address the meeting in the relation of the legal Sabbath to Christianity. Presbyterians were really, really strong about Sabbath observance. Okay, they were very strict about that traditionally. Okay, but then there was also the Reverend Alexander, who is pastor of the Upper Path Valley Presbyterian Church, which includes Amberson Valley. So we have a Methodist basically moderating the meeting. We have these two Presbyterian ministers who are preaching. Alexander talked about temperance. Temperance was a big subject among Methodists and Presbyterians back in the 1800s, early 1900s. Now, the interesting thing was that it was a big subject, and it was something that was promoted very heavily and so on. But the other reality was there was a lot of drinking among these people. Okay, there just was a lot of drinking. And so this is so temperance is seen as kind of a way to bring some correction to that major problem. here. So temperance by this time meant, you know, not drinking alcohol, period. Okay? Right? And it says, the citizens of Amerson Valley entertained the members and friends of the association royally, and most excellent music was rendered by the choir. All right? Now, that brings us to an end. One of the things I remember growing up is out here at the center school, we had an ice cream social, sort of a picnic and so on. And it was something that the churches here did, okay? But they would use the schoolhouse. The schoolhouse wasn't being used anymore as a school in my lifetime. But I remember that they would get sawhorses and boards, and they would kind of build tables around in a U-shaped thing. They'd string up lights and so on, and we would have chicken soup, bean soup, I think barbecue, and homemade ice cream. All right, and it was a thing to raise money and so on. And there was always a I remember they had a farm wagon, so they pulled in a farm wagon, and there was always a gospel group singing. Okay, and that was a big event. Now later on they built the community center, but that was sort of the community center was sort of an outgrowth of that kind of thing. But it was originally, and the churches had these quote unquote socials. My grandma's one aunt. She married in her late 30s and so on, but there was a set of postcards between her and her husband-to-be. They dated for a number of years. I think she was a little uncertain of him, and probably rightly so, because he was a bit of an alcoholic. She went to church and he didn't, okay? She was Presbyterian. She wouldn't let him have his beer in her house, so he had to drink warm beer down in his tool shed. I don't remember him. I do remember her. But these postcards, and unfortunately they were destroyed. But I remember reading them when I was a teenager. These postcards were basically consisting of, are you going to go to the social next on whenever it was? Okay, so that was a big part of their life was, and that kind of goes back to what Newton Culberson was talking about. You know, church was a social event. It was a time for the community to come together. It was a time for the interact. Of course, there was some spiritual input and so on. And there are certain, you know, I think one of the things we don't quite get any, that's really watered down, is that people would have assumed kind of a Christian, quote unquote, Christian framework. Whether or not they were really very serious about it and so on depended on the individuals. I remember my neighbor Sam Stewart talking about, and he would have grown up, he would have grown up Methodist, but his wife was Presbyterian. I never knew him to go to church. But he talked about when he was a young man, like a teenager, he worked for an Alexander near Spring Run, who had a grocery store in Dry Run. And I remember him saying about him, he was a Christian man. And he said, and I mean that, he was a Christian man. And he wouldn't have said that about most people. But this particular person, and I think he was actually an elder in the Presbyterian Church, he was a person who was known for being a person who really did try to live what he professed, okay? And that wasn't always the case. My grandfather, when I was growing up, I never remember him going to church. He was raised Methodist. Now, when my father was growing up, I remember my dad talking about it, my grandmother talking about it. I mean, they had five children. They came in here. By that time, the families were sitting together, and grandma said we would with her. My grandfather sat at one end, and my grandmother sat on the other end, and the children sat in between, and I will tell you, they behaved themselves. In fact, years later, after my dad quit school, he went over and he worked for a Mennonite farmer in the Chambersburg area, and he boarded there, and he went to Chambersburg Mennonite Church, and he was surprised, he was shocked. because all these boys sat back in the back and they would misbehave. So they would. In fact, he talked about there was this one bench in the back where somebody had actually taken a penknife and drilled a hole in the back of the thing. And so when the church was really crowded and those boys were packed in there like sardines, somebody would take a pencil and just worry that guy in front of them through that hole. I've always wondered. My dad wasn't, I mean, he liked them. I mean, he was friends with that family, up, I think, probably till the day he died. He liked them. They were good. They treated them fine and everything like that. But I just think, wonder if what it would have been like if there had been something more impressive there from the young people. How would that have impacted my dad? I don't know. It probably wouldn't have impacted him, but I just do wonder about that. But getting back to my grandfather. Now, in the 19th century, this would not have been the case. Noah Funston, in his class record, he has some notes alongside different persons. And one person he talks about fell from grace. So he had been a member, but probably had done something he shouldn't have done or just simply stopped attending. And so he fell from grace. Okay? But my grandfather, they attended church here. And one Sunday morning, there was this one person who came to church here. And he was an alcoholic, and he would get drunk on the weekends. But on Sunday morning, he got himself sobered up, and he came to church. And he was a regular attender, so he was. But one Sunday morning, he didn't get sobered up. And he came to church anyhow. And my grandfather was so disgusted by that, they said, I don't need to go to church if that's how people act. And so he stopped going to church. Now, the thing I never quite understood about that story was this man got drunk every weekend, okay? And so he was getting drunk, all right? But it just offended my grandfather's sensibilities that he would show up on a Sunday morning drunk. Now, my grandfather didn't approve of people getting drunk. Don't get me wrong there. But I just thought, well, you know, that's a little bit different way of looking at things, isn't it? Okay? And I would say that in the 19th century, there was more seriousness about the people who were dedicated, okay, who were committed, but there were lots of other people who weren't, okay? But even though they came to church, they probably weren't members or anything like that. But in the 20th century, that sort of thing kind of thinned out, all right? Sort of thinned out. And so you could have that happen, all right? Okay, that's enough. Oh, this is a picture showing, you can hardly see the Methodist church behind the trees. There's the Presbyterian church, there's the center school, and then there's the graveyard. That picture is probably taken around 1910. Okay. All right, I'm done. Will that turn it off? No, I have to turn it off. Okay. Okay, I'll turn it back over to you. All right. I'll just leave this up and take care of it.